Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Lorna Gibson. She is the Matula S. Salopatis Professor of Materials Science and Engineering and a McVicar Faculty Fellow at MIT. We're continuing our conversation about her unique book, Birds Up Close, An Engineer Explores Their Hidden Wonders. Lorna, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this extraordinary book.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks very much.
Now, to review, this is, for me, this was such a unique bird book. It's a science book, but it's not ornithology. It's a physics book, a materials science book about birds. And you did an amazing job on it. I sort of wish you'd go through the animal kingdom now.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I got to tell you a story. When I first had this idea, I told a colleague of mine at MIT, I was thinking about writing a book about birds and how they work. And she said, oh, and I was thinking of calling it How Birds Work originally, but there's another book called that. But she said, oh, you could make it a series, How Trees Work, How, you know, How This Works, How That Works. I'm like, hold on.
Well, yeah, but she's got a point.
It's like, yeah.
It's really funny. I think, first of all, people's science education needs a lot of bucking up. And it does give you a totally different view of the bird when you read this book. And I have to again mention, you love, visuals when you lecture, and it comes out in this book, and it's great. There's some fantastic, and it's a beautiful book, too. Now, we had been talking about feathers and their numerous functions, and we had talked previously about their colors and about iridescence, but I want to talk more about feathers and sound. And a lot of people may not associate bird feathers with sound, but in fact, there are several ways in which birds use their feathers as sound. Did you know that before you started this book?
I didn't know that, and it was one of the things that surprised me. And, I think last time I mentioned how many things about this just surprised me and amazed me as I was reading up on it and finding out. And certainly the sound was like that. I really had no idea.
Well, you talk about hummingbird dives. Can you describe a hummingbird dive?
Yeah, so some of the hummingbirds, the males do these courtship dives, and they fly up to a fairly high height, maybe 100 feet, something like that, and a female will be perched on a branch, just kind of watching, and the male will dive down vertically and can reach speeds of up to 50 miles an hour.
Wow.
And then at the bottom kind of pulls up and makes this U-turn and then pulls away from the whole thing, and the female's watching this whole thing. And there's really two things the male does that are they're incredible as this happens. So one is, and I guess I should mention not all hummingbirds do this, but
right.
Hummingbirds that are called bee hummingbirds, it's a whole class of hummingbirds do this. Sorry, that's a computer. And what they do is two things. So one is, as we mentioned last time, that iridescence has this property that as you change your viewing angle, the color changes. So, if you look at a patch of oil on water, as you move your head around, the color of the oil changes. As a hummingbird flies past, the colors on its gorget, the iridescent gorget, changes.
Wow.
And as the hummingbird, as the male does this dive, as it goes past the female and does the U at the end, the angle that she's viewing, the male, changes. And so there's a flash of color as the male goes by. And then simultaneously with that, the male does this thing where it splays its tail feathers so that the one feather is kind of not attached to the neighboring two, and it's free to flutter. And you remember when you were a kid and you took a piece of grass and you put it between your fingers?
Oh,
yeah. You made that buzz noise. That's kind of what happens with that feather that's free to move. It vibrates, and it makes a high-pitched sound. And the thing that's the most amazing about this is that the hummingbird synchronizes the flash of color of the iridescence with that little buzzing sound within 300 milliseconds, which is fast as the blink of an eye. And I should mention, Cassie Stoddard at Princeton was the one who really documented all this. She went to the Rocky Mountains. I think it was broad-tailed hummingbirds she looked at.
Yep.
And they had, several cameras set up taking video
so they could
kind of document this whole thing. So she was really the one who found out about this whole behavior.
What's interesting is when I read that section, I recalled seeing sound displays from two other types of birds, snipe and nighthawks. Nighthawks do, when they're, again, trying to attract a mate, they'll do a dive, and it makes a sound like a bull roarer. Those toys that used to have swung around your head. And it's all got to do with their feathers. So what's happening on their feathers that's creating a sound?
I don't know. I mean, I have read that the snipes do something similar to the hummingbirds. They have a feather. I can't remember if it's one of their wing feathers or their tail feathers that vibrates, and it's the vibration of that feather that causes the sound. I didn't know.
And it's a weird nighthawks, but I've only seen it at the beginning of the breeding season when they're doing it. Again, it's for a display. The snipe sound, by the way, is very odd if you've never heard it in person. It's like, it sounds like an eerie science fiction sound. It's called the winnowing flight, and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. It's very weird. It's very odd. Yeah. And if you didn't know it was a snipe, you'd think it was like something very strange. But
yeah, Chris Clark has done some nice experiments too on this. He's taken individual feathers and put them in a wind tunnel and then blown air at different speeds, and he's measured the vibration of the feather, and he's also acoustically looked at the frequency of the sound that the feather generates. And he's shown that the frequency of vibration of the feather is the same as the frequency of sound.
Wow. Now, feathers can create sound, and I'm so glad I read your book about this. But sometimes feathers can suppress sound. And in particular, there's a whole group of birds that try to fly as silently as possible, and that's owls. How is it possible for owls to fly silently?
Well, it's all in their flight feathers. They have special little structures on their flight feathers that are different from other birds. And I don't think it's understood exactly how it all works. But there's definitely three differences in the structure of the feathers. You look at the leading edge of the wing. So that, you know, if you think of the bird moving forward, mm-hmm. the edge of the wing that's closest to the front of the bird. On an owl, that has little serrations on it. And you don't find that in other birds. And it's thought that serration affects the flow over the wing. And if you don't have that, sometimes there's what's called separation. The flow kind of separates from the surface of the wing, and that can cause. And it's thought that serrated leading edge of the owl wing prevents that separation from happening. So that's one thing. Another feature is that the rest of the flight feathers have sort of a fringe on either side, and that those fringes kind of interdigitate, sort of like the teeth of two combs fitting together. And it's thought that then prevents the fluttering that we talked about with the hummingbirds and the snipes, so that the feathers can't vibrate, that they're sort of, fixed by the neighboring feather. And then on top of that, the surface of an owl feather, the flight feathers, have what's called a velvety surface. And what that is it's a sort of modification of the structure of the feather. If you think of a feather, there's the shaft, and then the vane is made up of barbs. And the barbs have a shaft, which you can see with your eye. And then there's another branching off of that called barbules, and they're very small. You can barely see them with your eye. And in an owl, those barbules are much longer than in other birds. And they're not sort of flat in the plane of the vane. They sort of stick out a little bit. And it's thought that might reduce the turbulence at the surface of the feather of the wing and reduce sound that way. And so it's thought that these three features, the serrations on the leading edges, the fringes at the edges of the feathers, and then these velvety surface on top of the feathers, it's thought that those all work to reduce the sound. And one thing I might mention, if you go to YouTube and you Google BBC Silent Owl Flight, they have a really lovely video where they've got a long table set up with a whole array of microphones, and they fly three birds between one end of the table and the other. They fly a pigeon, a peregrine falcon, and a barn owl. And then they measure the sound as the birds fly across the microphone. And it's incredible. You know, the pigeon, you can just imagine kind of goes, pigeons doing that just in the city. But the peregrine falcon makes quite a noise too. And the owl is almost completely silent. And, you know, they show the little sound wave of the different birds, and the owl is almost nothing. So it's kind of cool to see this little 2-minute video on the BBC.
Well, I can tell you from experience, because I've gone out owling in pitch black. And, you know, you're trying to call an owl in, and you don't think anything's showed up because you haven't heard. It's totally still, and you haven't heard anything. And then the damned owl will scream right next to your head. And that gets you right down into your intestinal tract. I'll tell you that much.
I had an experience like that, too. I live near the Arnold Arboretum in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
And last year, a pair of great horned owls were nesting there. And there was a platform where the nest was, and you could stand, not close to it, but nearby, and you could see it. And I was standing there. It must have been like, you know, early evening one day. And I didn't hear a thing. And an owl flew from behind me, and then all of a sudden it was in front of me and on the nest. And, you know, I didn't hear it coming at all.
It isn't.
And you know, when you think about it, the owls, they hunt by their hearing.
Right.
And so the silent flight really has two purposes. One is that the owls themselves need to be able to hear. So if their wings made a lot of noise, it would make them harder. It would make it harder for them to hear their prey rustling around. And the other is they don't want their prey to hear them either, so that it really works for them both ways.
Now, you learned so much from your book that I didn't even know, that the things that we were talking about to reduce sound are actually, people have started to design low-noise wind turbine blades based on the design of feathers on owls' wings.
That's right. Siemens has a wind turbine blade that has like little fringes on the I think it's on the trailing edge of it, and it's based on the owl feather.
Now, feathers are also used for helping collect sound for the bird, and this goes for owls, but also harriers have a similar situation. How is that? It's the feathers on their head.
Yeah, it's the feathers on their head, and if you think of a barn owl, it's a very distinctive ruff. There's sort of that brownish feathers that make the sort of heart-shaped thing around the edge of its face. And then there's white feathers inside of that, you know, near the bill. And if you look at the structure of those two feathers, they look very different. The white feathers on the inside have the barbs of the vein fairly far apart, so they're spaced far apart. And that allows the sound to transmit through those feathers because there's just not much vein there. They're sort of separated. And the ears are just inside of the brown ruff. And if you look at the ruff feathers, those feathers, the vein is very densely packed. The barbs are very, very close together, and it's very densely packed. And those are called reflector feathers, and they reflect sound into the ears of the bird. And so, you know, the feathers themselves help the bird hear. But then there's more to it than that, actually. If you look at the owls and you look at the ruff, it turns out the feathers on one side are more upward facing, and the feathers on the other side are more downward facing. And in addition to that, the ears on the owl are at different heights. If you look at an owl's skull, you can see that the skull is asymmetrical, and even though you can't actually see the ears on the skull, the position of the skull and that asymmetry reflects the position of the ears. So you've got this thing where the ears are at different heights, and then the ruff feathers themselves are facing either upward on one side and downward on the other side. And so it means that sounds from above are louder in one ear and sounds from below are louder in the other ear. And that helps the owl detect exactly where the sound's coming from.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Lorna Gibson. She is the Matula S. Salopatis Professor of Materials Science and Engineering and a McVicker Faculty Fellow at MIT, and she has written one of the most intriguing and fascinating books about birds. Birds Up Close, An Engineer Explores Their Hidden Wonders. Lauren, the other thing that is fascinating, if you watch birds long enough, even in a park, is feathers and them being water repellent. You look at waterfowl, mallard ducks. It doesn't matter if it's a mallard duck or some unusual winter visiting waterfowl. How are feathers so hydrophobic? Why aren't ducks just being sucked under the water?
Well, you know, when you see ducks, almost their entire body is out of the water.
It's weird.
And the only way that works is if the feathers, the outer feathers, are very water repellent, and then there's a lot of air trapped in the down, and that air kind of gives them the buoyancy. So that's why they kind of sit up high in the water. So the water repellency, it's an interesting story. So I guess I should probably start with if you just have a solid, flat surface and you put a water droplet on, if you have different materials, the water either beads up or spreads depending on what the material is. So if you put water on wax, it beads up, and if you put water on glass, it spreads out. And the reason for that is there's different surface properties of the different materials. If you think about the atoms in a material, in the bulk of the material, somewhere in the middle of it, there's other atoms all around it, and there's bonds between all those other atoms. And you know, that's kind of the geometry of it. But if you look at an atom at the surface, there's no atoms above it. And so the bonding at the surface is different from the bonding in the middle. And in the middle of the material, where the bonds are all around, that's a more stable situation than the atom on the surface. It's less reactive. And so the atom on the inside, in the bulk, has a lower energy than the atom at the top. And so there's something called surface energy, which basically measures that. So different materials have different surface energies. And if you put a drop of material on a solid surface, it'll take up a form that tries to minimize the overall energy, the total energy. So the shape of the drop depends on the surface energy materials involved.
You have great illustrations of this in the book.
Yeah, and this is much easier to understand if you have the illustrations.
I know that you believe that, and there's some great illustrations of this. So what's happening on a duck's feather?
Yeah, so the duck is a different situation. So there were two guys in England during World War II.
Cassie and Baxter.
And Baxter. And they worked at the Wool Industries Research Association, which I always think is just an incredibly English kind of thing.
It sounds very British.
And the British Army had a lot of wool clothing, wool pants, wool coats.
Hey.
And they were trying to make wool clothing more water repellent. And wool is obviously made of fibers. It's not a flat, solid surface. And so they got interested in what's the water repellency if you have fibers instead of a flat, solid surface. And the wool had a complicated geometry, so they tried to make something simpler. And they started out by looking at just having rods, so rods of wire that were all the same diameter, all the same spacing. And they put droplets of water on it, and they measured this contact angle, which is the measure of the water repellency. And they found that if you controlled the spacing of these rods, you could increase the water repellency. And then they sort of said to themselves, well, what has sort of parallel rods that we could look at? And duck feathers. They looked at duck feathers. And you can think of the barbs that I said, you know, the feather structure has the main shaft, and then the barb shafts come off that, and the barbules come off that. So they measured the radius and the spacing of the barbs and the barbules, and they plugged it into their calculations, what the water repellency should be. And they found that you could explain the water repellency of the duck feathers by their model for how the, you know, surface energies of the rods worked out. And it's interesting, at the end of their paper in 1944, they have a statement, and I'm not going to have it word for word, but basically they said, if you want to make a cloth structure with the water repellency of a duck, you should focus on the structure of the cloth, not some waterproofing agent or, you know, wax or something. And they never were able to make clothing that was water repellent, but they planted the seeds of how it works. And today, if you go to an outdoor store and you buy a raincoat, it often will have something called a DWR coating on it, a durable water repellent coating. And that coating is based on the structure of a lotus leaf. And lotus leaves have little vertical posts that stick up from the surface, and those posts make them very water repellent too. And the people who've analyzed those posts in the lotus leaves have used the same method as Cassie and Baxter, just adapted it for that different geometry of parallel vertical posts instead of parallel horizontal rods. And they've now developed this durable water repellent coating, which is based on the vertical posts in a lotus leaf. And it all traces back to Cassie and Baxter looking at duck feathers and looking at the water repellency of duck feathers.
I love stories like that.
It's a wonderful story. I love telling that story.
I'd like to know more about Cassie and Baxter, though.
So would I. And I actually tried to dig up some information on them, and I really couldn't find out anything about them besides their work on water.
Well, they're like these unsung heroes of how we figure stuff out. You know,
absolutely. And in fact, you know, I mentioned the coats, but people are very interested in water repellent coatings for all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Like I think you can buy, you know, something to put on your windshield to make your windshield so that the, you know, rain slides off it easier. And I think the people who look at that also use Cassie and Baxter's equations in their analysis. You know, when I talked to my fluid mechanics friends at MIT and I told them about the duck feathers and I said, Cassie Baxter, they were all, oh, yeah, yeah, Cassie Baxter. We know Cassie Baxter. You know, like, it was something that, like Newton's laws of motion or something. They all knew about Cassie Baxter.
But that's two people, isn't it?
It's two people, yeah.
Were they saying it like, it's Cassie Baxter?
Because their paper was written together, people kind of refer to it as the Cassie Baxter model. Or
wow, that's the next book you got to write. Let's learn about Cassie and Baxter. Now, lastly, we got to talk about feathers as thermal insulation. And being in the Northeast, there's nothing like being out in really cold weather, like sometimes below zero, and watching these chickadees, these kinglets and nuthatches just sort of going about their business after a particularly cold night when they've been out. What is it about feathers, and how are birds using feathers to create insulation?
Yeah, well, their down creates the insulation, and the down is below their contour feathers, the outer feathers. And the down has a little bit different structure. In fact, if you have a down coat or a down duvet or something, you've probably seen what a piece of down looks like. You know, there's a shaft, but it's much more fluffy.
Yeah, kind of yeah, yeah.
It's much fluffier. And the down traps air, and that's really the secret of it. And in the book, I talk about comparing feather down with like an insulating foam, like a closed cell polyurethane foam thing. And they both work kind of the same way. There's different mechanisms that heat can move through materials. One is just solid conduction, so that just depends on how much solid you've got. And one is conduction through air. And air has a much, much lower thermal conductivity than solids, like a factor of 10 than, say, a polymer like polyurethane or keratin made from the solid. So trapping a lot of air is the first thing, and that really, most insulating materials work by trapping some sort of low conductivity gas. So one is that they trap gas. Another is that the volume fraction of solid, of keratin, is very, very low. You know, if you have a down feather, it almost floats in the air. It's
oh, yeah.
A little solid to it.
Well,
so a low volume fraction of solid helps, too. Were you going to say something?
These birds also, when you see them first thing in the morning, they look like puffballs. I mean, they've rearranged the feathers so that they've trapped that air, I guess? Is that what's happening?
That's exactly what they're doing. In the wintertime when it's cold, you can see them sort of fluff up so that their bodies are almost this little spherical ball.
It's exactly.
On the top and a tail stuck in the other end. And that's really, they fluff their feathers up to try to trap more air. That's what they're trying to do there. And the other thing that does is a sphere has the smallest surface area per unit volume. So, you know, the heat moves through the surface area. So by having a small surface area, you're also helping with keeping warm as well.
We're almost out of time, but I have to mention bills in one regard. And everybody asks this, and it seems like a simple question. I just want to know, do we understand how woodpeckers don't damage their brains?
Well, I wrote a paper on this.
I know. That's why I wanted to ask you.
And I actually, with MITx, the sort of online version of MIT, we made a cute little video series called Built to Peck. And it's really, we go to the Museum of Comparative Zoology. We do a little tour. And I talk about how it works. But the nutshell is, it's because their brains are much smaller than ours. So if you think of force as a mass times an acceleration, our brains weigh about 1,400 grams. An acorn woodpecker brain weighs 2 grams. And it's a little more complicated. It's not really just force. It's the force per unit area that is important.
Right, right, right.
But since the mass goes as a volume, so a length cubed, a radius cubed, and the area goes as radius squared, this a length scale gets worked into there. So the fact that their brains are very small is a big part of the explanation of how they can withstand brain injury. How they can withstand pecking without having brain injury. But if you want to see all the details, I really do recommend you look at the little video series. It's on YouTube, Built to Peck. And we go to Hall's Pond in Brookline,
oh,
Massachusetts.
Yeah. I've actually birded at Hall's Pond.
For Hall's Pond because I'm on the board of directors of Mass Audubon, and Minna Hall was one of the founding mothers of Audubon.
Absolutely,
her cousin Harriet Hemingway, and she lived right by Hall's Pond, and she went birding there most of her life, I think. And it's a little sanctuary now. So we talk about that. We talk about the Museum of Comparative Zoology. They have an ivory-billed woodpecker. They have an ivory-billed woodpecker nest. And so it's really wonderful to look at the video if you get a chance to do that.
First of all, I want to say I love Hall's Pond Sanctuary. It's small. It's like a postage stamp. But
it's tiny, yeah.
But it's great because it's the middle of an urban environment. And all sorts of birds are attracted to it.
Yeah, and actually the other cute thing is it's right near Fenway Park. And there's an intersection near Fenway Park of Park Street and Beacon Street.
Yep.
And it's called Audubon Circle. And there's all these black steel cutouts of birds on the lamppost. And it's called that because Minna Hall lived a few blocks from there.
And that's a great story, by the way, about Minna. And, I mean, that's another story for another time. Are there aspects, and this is the last question, aspects of birds that you would still like to figure out from a material scientist point of view?
I think there must be lots more. I mean, I've sort of focused on...
You've really covered a lot of ground in this book, I want to mention.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's not comprehensive. It was just things that I found interesting and that I was amazed by. And, you know, I would go to MIT and I would tell my colleagues, you're not going to believe this. Birds, you know, do this thing. And they're like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, we were all stunned about it.
we're gonna stop there, Lerner. But I want to mention, we've only talked about essentially two chapters in a great book that has a lot of other material in it, including about bills. And there's a lot of other subjects to talk about bills. But you'll have to get the book. My returning guest tonight is Lerner Gibson. She is the Metula S. Salapatis Professor of Materials Science and Engineering and a McVicker Faculty Fellow at MIT. And she's written an amazing, interesting book, Birds Up Close, An Engineer Explores Their Hidden Wonders. Lerner, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for the invitation to join.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.